I'm Steve Lascalzo, and this is The Way. The podcast you're listening to now is my first impressions of the latest episode of The Mandalorian, Chapter 19, The Convert. I'm still in a little bit of shock. I thought for sure that I knew what was coming. Boy, was I wrong. This episode kept me guessing and gave me the kinds of things I didn't even know I wanted. I'm not calling this peak Star Wars. I think I did that last week. But this episode was amazing, and I can't wait to talk about it.
This is the way.
This is the way. This is the way.
So, early in the morning, I'm opening up the Disney Plus app, and I'm heading to the Mandalorian page. Right away, I see Bo-Katan on the thumbnail. Then I read the description, and it mentions Imperials finding amnesty on Coruscant. I'm confused. I mean, I knew I was wrong when I said last week we wouldn't pick back up with Din Djarin and Bo-Katan in this episode. But then I see her picture, and then I find out, oh no, we are going to head to Coruscant and check on Pershing. We saw him in the trailer, so we knew it was going to happen. And I know from experience, all the trailer footage gets used up by episode 6 of whatever season you're watching, and then most of it gets used up before the halfway point. The description told me we're going to see him. He's right there in the previously on segment, too. Oh, and by the way, how appropriate was the line,
"This is Dr. Pershing. His enthusiasm outweighs his discretion."
His enthusiasm outweighs his discretion. If you know, you know, right? I had no idea how they're going to tie two things together like that, but I was excited to find out. After the previously on stuff and we picked back up in the Chamber of the Living Waters, things started to feel off for me about the episode. I know, sometimes you see a miracle and you still doubt. I mean, that happens. It tracked for me. But I wanted Bo-Katan to be an instant convert. You know, this was before I saw the episode title. And if you're not aware, early in the morning when the episode's released, episode titles aren't widely available. It's not that easy to come across them by accident. So at this point in the first watch, I'm just hyper alert. I'm wide-eyed, even that early in the morning. So I see him take the water into that little vial thing. And I thought to myself, that looks like the thing the armorer uses, you know, when she's making armor and then she pours something into the water. If you aren't aware, blacksmiths that forge metal have used all sorts of different liquids to quench and temper. And though we aren't told how, it does seem that what the armorer has been pouring into the vats is crucial to this Beskar tempering process. Tempering and quenching are things done to improve the hardness, and maybe the water in the mine is high in some special mineral. Maybe it's just salt, but maybe it's a special oil or something that interacts with the waters around it. There sure is something to it, because whenever she pours it in, there's that shimmer or green glimmer. That's not there by accident. It's not happening in the camera when they're shooting it. That's something that's specifically added for us, the viewers. It's a quick scene, but I think it's a big deal. And though we wonder, and we're left to wonder, just like some characters do later, how's he going to prove he was there to the armorer? This was all the proof you need. This is the way.
Can I ask you something?
What is it?
You see anything down there?
I saw the chasm passing me as I fell.
I loved how Bo-Katan's doubt was played. It could have been a real bummer to see her go right back to scoffer and skeptic, but she's shaken here a little bit. She's kind of looking for a way forward with this new knowledge, this new perspective. I tell you what else I noticed. The mention about the bombings triggering seismic activity.
I didn't realize it was so deep.
It wasn't. The bombings from the Purge must have triggered seismic activities.
That's the answer to where was the Mythosaur all this time. We know it was probably deeper, probably driven farther underground, you know, by the mining. And then, after millennia or centuries or whatever, it's finally given away back up from the bombings. So, in that way, the scarring of this world by the bombing allowed healing. The deep waters are the evidence and a representation of that healing. Before they go, though, Bo-Katan asks, did you see anything alive down there? Din Djarin doesn't really react to it. No, I didn't see anything. He only says, like what?
Did you see anything alive?
Alive? Like what?
Nothing. Let's get out of here.
But she looks longingly back at the water. Then they leave, and he offers his eternal gratitude or something like that. And they joke on the ship about his helmet not coming off again. But instead of ridiculing him or making a comment, she lets her guard down, and she's done it before. But this time I realize something when she gives his line back to him.
You will forever have my gratitude.
I would invite you in for a feast, but I'm guessing that helmet isn't coming off again.
This is the way.
This is the way.
Leaving the helmets on for the Children of the Watch is like a dehumanizing tactic for those that follow the cult. If you don't see their face, you don't have to think about the pain in the face as they die in battle, or their emotions. They're making themselves more like droids, more interchangeable, and even though Din Djarin hated droids at the outset of the series, they're trying to eliminate their emotions between each other. They're trying to become a collective. In all the fighting between all the clans, it ends up you're just a color of paint on top of Beskar armor. You know, you're a banner rather than a real human with real emotions. You don't have to see the faces of your fellow Mandalorians as you're fighting and killing each other. This custom, I used to think, was honorable and almost romantic. Bo-Katan is fighting against what she calls the cult, even though this helmet thing was a brand new invention for this show, not even followed by Death Watch, remember. But in order to get her people back together into a collective, is she going to find out, you have to give up your sense of self? It's quite interesting to me. I haven't really thought about it that long, so I don't have a fully, cohesive thought in my head about this and about how it might relate to the Jedi foregoing attachments. They don't have helmets, but they try to tell you, listen, forego all attachments, because then you're going to experience loss, and then you're going to experience hate and suffering. But it's not all thought out in my head, but it was something that I was thinking about. These Mandalorians keep fighting. Why? Because they're not humans under this. They're just pawns on a chessboard for the people who are in charge. And I think with Bo-Katan trying to rally the troops, so to speak, she's having difficulty with that. And so maybe becoming part of this group now gives her a new path. Is she going to take this path? Or is she going to realize that maybe this isn't the means to her end either? I don't know. I've got to think more about it. Back to the show. And don't think I didn't notice when they looked at Grogu when he stirred and, spoke a little bit. I think it's because he sensed trouble. But again, he can't speak. He can't tell them, hey, look out.
We took a hit.
Something's coming up on us fast. It looks like a squadron of TIE interceptors.
So it's TIE interceptors coming, and for some reason they picked today to hunt down Bo-Katan? Why? I mean, why was it today? It doesn't really matter, okay, but it does lead to this great space and air battle above Kalevala. Mommylorian Bo-Katan is going to keep Grogu safe in the gauntlet. Daddy Din Djarin is going to drop in on his N1 and provide backup. I enjoyed the callback to the Siege episode where he does that climb in the Razor Crest and then drop. And when you think about it, it's kind of like the opposite of Top Gun Maverick's drop and climb, right? Oh, and I noticed Grogu's back to locking himself in the pram when there's danger he can't face. Makes a ton of sense. I mean, unless he was going to pop out and start manning a gun, what are you going to do, right?
Bo, listen to me. You have to get out of there. There's too many of them.
We've got to get out of here.
Din convincing her to run when they bombed her home, that was a big deal, I think. To me, that shows, hey, I've still got something left to fight for. Instead of staying and fighting and dying, probably, she doesn't argue. She goes with Din Djarin. Her choice is, let me go with this new family unit. And it is going to pay off for her. We get the title card, The Convert. I think it's referring to Bo-Katan, but you could make a case for one of the characters we're going to revisit in the bulk of the remainder of the episode. Coruscant is looking beautiful. I loved in this episode when we got to hear tidbits about the planet. We see the mountain peak peeking up from the ground in the park. I think that's going to cause all sorts of problems for the cityscape design, but I'm letting that slide because we've seen it before. I think Dave Filoni really shines in this episode, or really has his influence or his finger on this episode, because it appears in the Clone Wars episode, Duchess of Mandalore. It's a meeting spot for Obi-Wan Kenobi, and are you ready for this? Not Bo-Katan, but Satine Kryze, sister of Bo-Katan, and the ruler of Mandalore at one point. Wow.
They say it's the only place on the entire surface where you can see the planet itself.
Strange.
We hear confirmation in this episode that some of the weekdays are, in fact, as they appeared in the DeAgostini Press Build the Millennium Falcon magazine. So Bendu's Day and Tong's Day are now canon days of the week in Star Wars.
Good morning, L-52. Happy Bendu Day.
Bendu's Day is actually a reference to monks, not the Bendu in Rebels, but these monks that were on the planet of Coruscant at one point, and I guess either they worshipped or observed religious practices regarding the Bendu. I mean, that would be a heck of a coincidence if it wasn't. That's the character that appeared in Rebels. But in researching it for this podcast, I saw that the Imperial crest of 8 spokes coming out of the center disc actually is something this religious order cooked up. They were into numerology, and the number 9 was very important. It represented itself by 8 spokes and then one disc in the center. So that's kind of interesting. Bendu's Day corresponds to Friday on our calendar. Then there is Tong's Day.
Tong's Days, am I right?
Named after a species native to Coruscant, or once native, at least. So since they say Tong's Days, am I right? I'm going with that being Wednesday. Or, you know, the galaxy's hump day, so to speak. So we got TGI Bendu's Day and Tong's Days, am I right? From a little research, it seems Monday is called Prime Day, relating to the star at the center of the Coruscant system, almost like Sunday. But I don't know, like, their days may be a little differently, because I can only find 5, not 7 days of the week. So if Prime Day is actually Sunday, then Wednesday or Bendu's Day would actually be a different day of the week, like Thursday. But Sentax Day, I think, is Tuesday, relating to the primary moon of Coruscant, Sentax 1. So that could actually be, if it's a moon, it could be Monday. So maybe that's true. Then there's Zell Day or Thursday in the galaxy. And like Tong's Day, it was referring to a creature native at one time to Coruscant, like they're called the Zell. And Tong and Zell are apparently some kind of a club at the University of Coruscant. So if Prime Day is Sunday, and then Sentax Day, referring to the moon, is Monday, then Tong's Day would actually be Tuesday, right? And then Zell Day would be Wednesday. And then Bendu's Day would be Thursday. Then we still need a Friday and a Saturday on our calendar. Not sure. If you know, please let me know. There are lots of details in the Coruscant story that I want to pore over, and I noticed a lot of them. There was the biscuits, and coming on Ted Lasso Day of all days too, right? Ted Lasso season 3 premiering on the 15th. There's a shot of Aliyah Kane where she retreats into the dark when she's asked that question by Pershing. Wow. Really, really good. And I noticed it. I'm sure most of people did too. There's the numbers of the officers, dehumanizing them from their names, just like the helmets of the Children of the Watch. They were almost like bingo numbers, you know, G68 and, you know, L42, or I don't know what they were. I'll have to go and watch Better Call Saul's bingo episode to see if any of those are homages, but maybe it's in reference to something else, and someone else figures that out. There's the Opera House scene, you know, with Pershing standing there. Kind of made me think about the Darth Plagueis the Wise speech. There's the It's a Trap gag with the Mon Cala officer and Pershing. A Mind Flayer reference. Proof that the New Republic isn't all that great. I mean, in Andor we had Dr. Gorst and the torture, and this machine sure did seem like it was set up for torture, especially if there's a dial that lets you take it up to 11, you know. I mean, if they're not really trying to torture you, then why is that dial go all that way, right? I thought it was interesting to see this version of Operation Paperclip. The way that America and the Allies allowed Nazis to integrate if they thought they could be of use. Not to go biblical again. Well, no, I am. I'm going biblical again. In the Old Testament, a lot of times God had the Israelites wiping out conquered peoples in the Old Testament so that his people, his chosen people, wouldn't allow evil to seep in. I mean, it went down to don't take any plunder, don't take their cattle even, don't let anyone live, kill them all, no slaves, you know, don't take anything, just, you know, banish them from existence. It was about not allowing a foothold. But we see that echoed here. Dr. Pershing claims all of his feelings are about the science and helping people, but it's really just to satisfy his ego and what he sees as his purpose. If the New Republic throws out his research, like some of that Imperial tech that he sees being archived, well, then it's throwing out his purpose in his mind. Aliyah Kane, the other character that's featured in this episode heavily, she seems, at the end, to be a total convert to the New Republic way. But is she? That's one of the great things I see about this actress's portrayal. I still don't know. Is she with the budding First Order? I think everything tells us that she is, right? She prefers the red biscuits to the yellow ones. She seems to be following Operation Cinder, which was the order given by Palpatine. If he should die, then wipe out all semblances of the Empire. And then it seems like her wiping Pershing's memory is fulfilling that. But she could just be damaged goods. She could just have been converted, and then she sees punishing him as good for the New Republic. There's so much layering to what happened. I thought for sure in this episode she was going to lead him somewhere, and oh look, there's Moff Gideon recruiting him, or some person, you know, recruiting for Palpatine through a third party. I felt like Favreau and the other scriptwriter on this project, Noor, were leading us down this path. Then nope.
Morningfleed.
So we finish up with all of the stuff in Coruscant, and I thought, okay, end of the episode. But wait, there's more.
I'm bringing you to a Mandalorian covert. This is how we have survived in exile.
I'm familiar.
I did not check to see how long the episode was before I started. I did feel maybe last episode was so short, because maybe the first part of this episode was supposed to be part of the last one, and then it was going to end when they jumped to light speed, right? When Din and Bo-Katan jumped to light speed, maybe that was supposed to be the end of episode 2 of season 3. And then maybe this episode was originally just going to be all set on Coruscant, then end with the torture scene. But then they maybe tacked on what was going to be part of Chapter 20 to the end here. I don't know. I have no evidence of that.
They still live by the old ways.
Yes. It will go smoother if you keep your helmet on. Trust me.
Of course.
But we do see Din Djarin and Bo-Katan come out of hyperspace, and he's taking her with him to the covert. So the convert visits the covert.
He speaks the truth. I was witness.
And who are you, Night Owl?
I am Bo-Katan of Clan Kryze.
Your house has fallen from the way. You are both apostates.
We have been to the living waters. I bring proof.
We shall see.
In this visit, she is respectful, and I think she's changed. It's either that or there are too many of them, but she walks in willingly. She enters the cave. The cave is very symbolic. She enters the cave under her own free will, something that's important. We hear the armor pronounce it, but it wasn't the words that made it so, right? It wasn't even the water, I think. She ends up almost immediately being accepted, despite what we heard in the Book of Boba Fett from the armorer's own mouth. I thought for sure there was going to be some conflict between Paz Vizsla and Bo-Katan, but we didn't see it. Bo-Katan didn't observe the way before. Now, suddenly, she's got another chance. All has been forgiven. All you gotta do is not take off your helmet.
Did you bathe in the waters?
I did. And have you removed your helmet since?
No, I have not.
I have to admit, even though Din Djarin mentioned it, part of me wanted her to take that helmet off. But I think she wanted this. I don't think she thought it was possible, but now that it's presented to her, I wasn't sure it was possible. Now she's found something she didn't know she wanted. Acceptance by the Children of the Watch.
Then you may join our covert and live as your ancestors once did. You may leave anytime you wish. Until then, you are one of us. Welcome, Bo-Katan of Clan Kryze. This is the way.
This is the way.
I thought this was a great episode, at least initially, right? These are my initial thoughts on Season 3, Episode 3 of The Mandalorian. I'd love to speculate on where we're going next, but I have no idea. And I like that. That's awesome. I will talk more about the scenes on Coruscant. I do want to do a deep dive on the entire episode, but I didn't want to get bogged down right now on those minute details. There's a lot going on. Well, my grandmother is ill, and so I'm a bit distracted, and then my family was supposed to take a quick spring break trip, but now I don't know. So if you're the praying kind, please say a prayer for my grandmother, Lorraine. She's the last grandparent I have left with me and with my family. She just turned 98, but I sure would appreciate prayer.
This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way. This is the way. This is the way.
There was no feedback episode again last week, so please send me some if you don't mind. thisisthewaypodcast@gmail.com. All our links can be found in one place at linktr.ee/thisisthewaypod. Our Twitter and Instagram links are @thisisthewaypod, and there are links to our YouTube and Twitch channels, Facebook, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. And Spotify for Podcasters is now the name for what used to be Anchor.fm. This is the way. I'm your host, Steve Lascalzo. Thanks for listening to This Is The Way Podcast's first impressions of Season 3, Episode 3 of The Mandalorian. It's called The Convert, Chapter 19. May the Force be with you. Always.